a portion of this sermon today will actually go into a little bit of that Navy experience that I had in the past. Because when Paul actually approached David and I of whether or not we would preach this Sunday, he did the 9:30, Pastor David did, and I'm here doing the 11. He told us what passage, and I looked at it and I said, really? That one? Because this one, if you actually open your Bibles, if you have them with you, to Luke 14, this isn't one of those. I was talking to a friend last night through text message, and I was like, this isn't one of those passages that's going to make you very many friends. This is one of those really tough passages, and actually going through and trying to prepare for it, one of the things that I found as a struggle for me was to find a like-for-like analogy, illustration of our world today to what Jesus is calling us to. And then a couple of weeks ago, I was actually hosting a number of youth pastors and youth leaders in our area to a kind of a conference meetup thing here. And I was presenting on small groups, and just extemporaneously in this conversation, I just shouted, "The Navy does discipleship really well." And I was like, oh, wow. I just use that for next week. And so that's where this illustration is going to come from. And another thing that I also learned, they let me up here after the technology issues we had on the 31st. I don't know why, but here I am. And I've decided to follow the ways and just use the clicker. So rather than having my computer up here and all that, we're just going to go right with this clicker. And so if you are following with us, we're going to be in 14 verses 25 through 35. And I think that through this, there's kind of, there we go. There's these four way stations. I thought about calling them the four wayses. That didn't come off very well. And then I realized I'm from California. There's just way stations all over the place. If you've ever been there, you know, there's a way station like every 20 miles, it feels like. And so we have these things called way stations. And so these are our four way stations that I think Jesus is trying to communicate to us through the words that he's going to tell us. He says, weigh your priorities, weigh your cross, weigh the cost, and then weigh his worth. This is not going to be an easy passage for us. And unfortunately, in going into this one and taking it verse by verse, it might be for some of us a difficult conversation to have. And I think for as much as this is a sermon to everyone in the room, this is a sermon to me as well, because oftentimes I miss the mark on this by way more than I would hope to admit. And so whether we have been with Christ for 20, 30, 40 years, whether you're brand new to the faith, or whether or not you're investigating Christ for the first time in your life, he who has ears, as Jesus will say, let him hear. And so here's the first way station as we get into it. Weigh your priorities. Here's the first section of this passage here. And he says this, now great crowds were traveling with him. This is Luke saying something about what's happening in this moment. And if you think back to that time in the first century for a teacher to have a number of people following him wouldn't have been a totally strange sight. Actually, today in our modern world, we do a very similar thing. What we do is we follow people on Twitter and we follow people on Instagram, or we follow people on their YouTube channel, or maybe there's this author that we know of or a theologian, and every single book, Tim Keller, every single book he writes or has written, you buy Bonhoeffer. And so the thing is you'll notice that I'll bring actually those two guys in because these are people that I enjoy reading. I want to be there to get the scoop on what they're going to say next. And so you'll notice that in our lives today, in our modern life, we do a very similar thing. We are going to be discipled and we're going to follow something. And the world knows this, which is why when you're on Instagram and you see a number of ads and they're throwing these things in front of you, all of a sudden you need those shoes. Or you hear enough TikToks that are covering the same thing, and then all of a sudden you're like, I didn't think of the world that way. And it's changing the way that you're seeing the world. Or you're scrolling through, you're watching something, you're watching the news media say something, and then they're quoting back someone, and then rather than giving us the context, they're taking what someone said, throwing it in front of your face, and then all of a sudden, what this person is saying is not what they meant. How many times do we see that in the world today, even with Christ? We're going to follow something. And in rabbinic tradition, it happened a lot. We can see throughout the Bible, there's more than just these, but this is just to give you the idea that for someone to be wanting to follow a teacher or a rabbi, it wasn't necessarily uncommon. In the Old Testament, we have Moses and Joshua. He trained him. We have Elijah and Elisha. Elijah left and Elisha took his place. We have Isaiah and his disciples. In Isaiah 8:16, he mentions them. And then also, just in the New Testament here, we have another example of John the Baptist and his disciples, whereof at least two are mentioned, but we think that it's two out of a number. And that's in John 1:35 through 37. For someone to be following after a teacher was as much a part of their culture today as it then as it is to us today. The thing is they had the opportunity to be following right behind the person that they are being discipled by. And so this goes into the next section here. This is what Jesus, just imagine, Jesus has a number of people. He walks out of a house. He is now in a town and he's walking through and a whole bunch of people are following behind him. And this is what Jesus says. These are a whole bunch of people who want to know what he's going to say. They want to learn from him. They want to follow him. They want to be his disciples. And this is what he says. He says this, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. What? Do you see why this is a hard passage? Jesus is all these people who are wanting to seek and follow after him, follow in his footsteps. He turns around to them and say, unless you hate everyone? That begs the question then, what is Jesus not saying here? Because to take the interpretation that we now have to hate everyone as disciples of Jesus would then go and fly in the face of pretty much everything else that he taught, right? We know that Jesus taught love. Twice in Matthew, just talking about fathers and mothers, he talks about how you need to honor your father and mother. And then one of those, he even says that it is like one of the highest parts of the law. And then also, we know that Jesus says, you have been told to love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I tell you to love your enemy. What Jesus is doing here is he's starting to call us out on something. What is our priority? Jesus is setting up these two choices. And which one are you going to hold as preeminent above everything else? And just a little bit ago, I mentioned the Navy, and you're going to see now why I think this is such a great illustration for us. Because if we're looking for a real life example of people who are willing to make a very similar sacrifice, we can see that with those who have served in any of the branches of the armed forces. Yes, we could also say for those who have gone and died for the sake of the gospel in other places, but many of us might not know very many people who have done that, sadly. And so this might be approachable for many of us in the room. This is actually from 2017, and that was my last deployment before coming here in 2018. And oh, look, this is me. You can tell by the nose. And actually that was, I didn't have that picture before, but I found it on an article while Googling on the internet for pictures from this deployment. And that one was actually in an article about how Navy pilots and Navy ground support for those aircraft have a very high rate of cancer. So that's me, and I'm the titular picture for this. But these four guys there, those were my night check. We worked together, served together, lived together for 9 months. And if you're going to take all the training for that deployment as well, over a year, eating, living, sleeping, working in the same place. These are all aviation electricians' mates doing the same work and the same job. All of these guys also, you see these final checkers that are up there. You have the two that are beneath the jet right there, just so you know, it's about to launch and it's like that just taxied. And so while the jet is moving, you go up there and you put hands on it to check it. The other one down here, you see those guys like this. right? You're saying that the jet is good to go. How do these people get to that position? How do they receive that qualification? By training, and yes, I think even a modeling of discipleship for us. Just to be able to go up on the flight deck, you have to have a certain amount of hours in training, where what happens is someone is standing right in front of you and you grab the back of their float coat, that white thing, and everywhere they go, you go. Just like this, right? There's over 30 aircraft up there launching, landing, all at the same time. You do not want to be in the wrong place. If they stand behind the black and yellow line, you stand there, the black and yellow line. If they do this, so it's the red and white line, you know what's about to happen? That jet's about to launch right behind you. And the amount of space between you and the other jet in front of you and behind you is just about the space between me and the front row. If you're standing in the wrong place, something might happen. If that person who's training you steps over a chain, you step over the chain. If they walk around it, you walk around it. If they go outside of the exhaust, then you go around it. If they go under it, you go under it. You're holding on to the back of them. And they have something very precious behind them because they have your life. And then the next thing too, to be a final checker, that's just your flight deck qual. To be a final checker, then what happens is you do the same thing again. Now you're qualified to be up on the flight deck. You're not going to get yourself or anybody else hurt. And so now what you're going to do is when you walk up to the jet and it's taxiing for you, you're going to be forward towards you. You're going to stand right behind that person again, and you're going to touch everything they touch. Every fastener that they look at, you're going to look at that fastener. Every light bulb that they go and they op check, you're going to light check those same light bulbs. Every tire, you're going to look at the tire and they're going to do this because you're making sure that there's not excessive wear. Everything that's dripping, you're going to count. You're going to look at these different dials. You're going to make sure the flight control systems are all working. And then what you're going to do is you're going to get down. If everything's clear, you're going to put your hand up in the sky with this thumbs up saying, this jet is good to go. And every time you put your thumbs up, what you're saying is, I have checked this and this person, this pilot is ready to fly. The only way you got to that position is because you were trained and discipled to do the job well. And it might look for some on the outside looking in on military service that for some reason, these are very, very strange people who are willing to give up everything for a mission that they believe in. They're willing to, when the Navy says it's time to go, you go. For my wife and I, our first year of marriage, we were probably together between like 6 and 8 months of our first year of marriage, because I was about to go on deployment. And for workups, you're gone for like 2 months at a time. You come back for a week, and you're gone for a month, and then you come back for a week. And then you spend 9 months away. It might look on the outside looking in, why would you make that? Jesus is saying the same thing. For the mission that I have and for you to follow me, everything else needs to look like a distant second. And then also there, he says what? You have to hate even your own life. There's that other cost. Back in March 14th of 2018, really near the time when I got out, two of our pilots had a failure in their aircraft, and it caused it to flip over. And they were coming in for a landing, unable to recover the aircraft, and they died. Every time you get into the jet, anytime that you're standing on a flight deck, anytime that you're doing anything, you know that at some point there might be a cost you have to pay. And these two pilots, one of them that I very, very highly respected, so much so, he gave me a quart of milk once because I asked for it on deployment because we get powdered milk and they get real milk. And I asked for a quart of milk and he gave it to me. And he was a great man. To lose them, you understand that they were willing to do it. That's why they did it. At some point, it might happen. They don't know if it's going to happen to them, but it might. You wish it didn't happen to someone in your squadron, but you understand that it will. Possibly, maybe. And then the first thing that happens is they start asking you, why did this aircraft go down? And then they start going through the investigation, and then you realize they're like, hey, Neil, you have 130 different MAFs, or kind of like maintenance action reports, that you signed off saying that it was done well. Were all of these done well? And you say, yes, they were all done well. You just hope that you were trained and they were trained and everyone was discipled to do the mission and accomplish it to the best of their abilities, even until it costs maybe possibly our life. Today in our modern life of Christianity, it doesn't seem kind of black and white like that. We can actually just come and we can say, yeah, I'm a follower of Jesus, and we can come on Sunday night, maybe on a Wednesday night, and then we can sign off and say everything's hunky-dory, I'm being a disciple of Jesus. But you see what he's saying? He's calling us to so much more. And if we want to experience what this life of a Christian looks like, and we want to be a part of it greater than we could ever imagine, then we need to step into faith and to give up the things he's going to call us to. A lot of times the church might feel like it's losing the battle. Are we not even fighting the battle right? Because our priorities have just been misplaced. No earthly loyalty can compete with our unwavering commitment to Christ. This is our second way station. Weigh your cross. So Jesus just got done telling everybody, hey, you got to hate all of your relatives, and then you can follow me. We got into a little bit he's saying something about priorities here. Everything else is going to be a distant second, and so now he's going to say something else. Whoever does not bear his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. We've probably heard that one a lot. And actually, last night I was here, and I was running through this, and I was kind of trying to I was praying a little bit and trying to, make these kind of maybe last minute changes on this. And what hit me was the people who were hearing this, they might be coming from a perspective of not understanding what Christ was going to do on the cross yet. He hadn't done it yet. When we come and we read this, we know what Jesus is going to accomplish. We know what he's going to do for us. But then on the other side, the people who are hearing this for the first time, the people who want to be his disciples, they're going to be thinking, wait, only guilty people carry crosses. Have we understood what our position and what our place is? We call out to Christ, and I think what we're really good at doing is bearing Jesus' cross. We're really good at saying, oh yeah, I have sinned, you took care of that. Oh, yeah, I didn't do that what you wanted me to do. I didn't step out in faith and do what you called me to do, but it's okay because you took care of that already. Do we live in that kind of life of Christianity? Or are we living a life of discipleship which says, I'm going to bear my cross and understand the person that I am? I am a youth pastor, and so I have for you some sort of like image here. And this is my float coat. I washed it. It's a lot less black now. And it smells less like grease and fuel. But this is what kind of, it denoted to everyone what my job was on the flight deck. It says that I was a final checker. White means that you're there for safety. Green meant that you were a maintainer, so I wore green and white. Some people wore white and white, but white and white gets really dirty, if you can imagine. And so this right here is what you bear when you go on the flight deck. Anytime you go up during flight ops, you wear this. This thing saves your life. If you fall off, there's three different ways. If you fall off the boat, there's three different ways that this will inflate. The first one, oxygen pack. What happens if it gets wet? CO2, it's not oxygen. It's CO2. It'll fill up this whole thing and then you'll float. If that doesn't work, well, then you have this pull string and that will inflate it. And if that doesn't work, right here, you got this little tube. Well, if you fall from five stories up. And then also right here is your die pack. Because if you're unconscious and you're just floating around, hopefully they can see you in the ocean. And the other thing as well is this right here is a beacon. When that gets wet, it'll illuminate. Every morning when we get into the shop, we had to op check this and make sure that it would work. And we'd wear it, and we'd put it on, And I think what it does is it's going to kind of maybe get across the idea that it's doing two things. For one, just like Jesus's cross and what he did, it saves our lives. It saves our souls. In this cosmic battle between eternity with him and eternity without him, it will inflate and our lives will be saved. The other thing too is when we put on that float coat, it's telling everyone around you who you are and what your job is. When we as Christians bear our own cross, we're going to show everyone around us who we are and what our job and what our mission is. There's a reason why on the back of this float coat, it says 220. So they know what squadron you're a part of. There's a reason why it says Alpha Alpha 9 220, TAC 011. That's saying, you know exactly who I am just by the number. Just on the float coat that person is wearing. You know their job, you know what they're going to do. How many people, when they look at our lives, see a people and a body of Christ bearing their crosses? And if they did, they would see a people on mission for Christ to join in his suffering, to see the gospel advance. Every disciple has a cross to bear. That cross is dying to yourself, to put aside your priorities and your wants and the advancement of our own tiny, petty little kingdoms for the advance of his. Then he's going to ask us to weigh the cost. He says this, "For which of you wanting to build a tower doesn't first sit down and calculate the cost to see if he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, after he has laid the foundation and cannot finish it, all the onlookers will begin to ridicule him, saying, 'This man started to build what he wasn't able to finish.'" So have any of you been downtown in Cleveland recently? There's that Sherwin-Williams HQ being built. It's like, it's there. You got the central tower. You have some of the floors there. And what if they all just stopped? What if it didn't finish getting built? Just imagine that. And it's been like 5 years, 10 years. And we would be like, why did they build something that they didn't have the ability to finish? This actually happened in Chicago, and they dug a hole for the Chicago Spire, they were going to call it. They dug this giant hole, and they started putting in the foundation and the supports for this tower that they were going to build, and then the 2008 financial crisis hit, and that's when they started building this thing. It was 2006. Most of the teens were not even alive, and all there has been in the middle of downtown Chicago is a giant hole, which is now filled with water. And if I didn't look into this, I would have walked past that if I ever went to Chicago. I don't know why I would. But if I was walking by in Chicago, I'd be like, why did they start building a tower they could never finish? It's silly. And back in Jesus' time, you would have seen people who would be trying to build towers, and they wouldn't finish them. Another way that we can even put this, too, is some of you might have seen on Facebook a picture of me with an 8-foot back fence in our backyard, right? Our house was hit by a tornado, right? And so through that process, you're trying to figure out what can be fixed now and what needs to be fixed later. And just so you guys know, the house was a fixer-upper to begin with. And so now we have a fixer-upper that was broken and is now more broken. And we have an upstairs bathroom that hardly functions anymore because the longer we live there, it gets worse. And then we have a roof that's leaking. Both of these things need to be fixed. We have to sit down, weigh the cost of which one needs to be fixed now and which one maybe needs to hold off. Because this is the worst thing that can happen, and I'm not going to do this one because it's the worst case scenario. Worst case scenario, we pay a guy who's going to come fix the bathroom, pay another guy who's going to come fix the roof. We don't have enough money to finish it on either of them, so now we have no bathroom at all and no roof. That would be a really bad situation to be in. What we have to do is sit down and count the cost. Do we have enough to finish it? The next thing, this is what Jesus says, or what king going to war against another king will not first sit down and decide if he is able with 10,000 to oppose the one who comes against him with 20,000? If not, while the other is still far off, he sends a delegation and asks for terms of peace. You really hope a king does that, right? Doesn't put us into a situation to fight a war that we cannot win. We are currently in the midst of a struggle in a war, in which the victory is already assured. And so when we look there and we're sitting down and we're like, oh, we're only 10,000 against 20. Yes, but the victory is assured for us. Do we believe in Christ and his work, and do we believe in the kingdom enough to say that we will forsake everything and we know that he is worth the cost? There's a way of looking at this, and we can do this. If we are being asked to take a thorough look at the ledger, are we willing to pay the cost? He doesn't want us to say that cost is too high. What he wants us to do is when we look at it, we don't give up. What we do is we embrace him because he is worth it. He is worth everything. That tower, that kingdom will be built. That war, that cosmic struggle between eternity with him and eternity without him will be won because he has done it. For us, there will be a cost. Our priorities will have to change. But he is worth following him. This is our fourth way station, weighing his worth. This is what Jesus says here. In the same way, therefore, every one of you who does not renounce all his possessions cannot be my disciple. I'm going to read a passage here. I highlighted it a second ago. One second. I'll find it. I'm sorry. Here it is. Matthew 6, 19 through 21. Some of you may know this. He says, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." What are those things that we hold so dear? This is one of those things, it's kind of a joke, but it's also a very sad reality of asking people to come and work in ministry in a lot of different ways, but especially for youth ministry. And what you do is you ask them like, hey, you would be great to serve with teens. Can you just step out in faith and maybe do it, try it out for a little bit? And they say, yeah, sure, I'll pray about it. And so if they are actually going home and praying about it, the overwhelming answer that happens from these prayers is God saying, no, don't invest in discipling young people because you have a 9-to-5. Or sometimes you ask a teen and be like, hey, how about you come and be a part of this discipleship group? And they say, no, I have homework every Wednesday night. Yeah, of course you have homework every Wednesday night. You're a teenager. One of the things that, just to give a shout out to one family, and this blew me away. They were so committed to have their teen go to summer camp last week that, or not last month, or sorry, last year, geez, working away over there, last year, that they sent him to camp. Then his dad flew down to Kentucky, picked him up, flew back here so that he could also make it to his baseball tournament. That was commitment. And it blew me away. I probably didn't tell him as much as it blew me away, but it blew me away. That showed commitment to discipling this young man in faith. But generally what happens is, oh, actually my kid is not available at all during the summer because X, Y, Z. And how many times in our own lives do we say, yes, I'm actually not going to step out in faith and do what Jesus has called me to because I have all. Jesus is telling us here and putting it down on the table, and he's playing his royal flush, and he's saying, to follow me and to be my disciple, you have to forsake all those things because they are just distractions. You're not going to accomplish what I have before you if you're distracted by 101 other things. Just to plug those youth leaders I do have, the vast majority of them actually have kids at home. And so then what they're doing is they're leaving their kids at home in one of their 2 days a week that they have off to come and disciple young children and teenagers here on a Sunday evening rather than putting their kids to bed. That right there is a life of discipleship. And for their families too, and their wives or their husbands who are doing that in their stead, this is a life of discipleship in a way that they are modeling it to teenagers. But oftentimes, to tell the, just for the way it is, the people that we're trying to feed into, we haven't yet, even for myself, bought into this picture of discipleship enough yet, even. Because then what we're doing is we're passing on a lackluster story and image of that discipleship. In short, renounce everything because nothing can have a hold on us. Only Jesus Christ can have that hold on us. And if you were worried that I was done and that Jesus was done talking, he wasn't. This is where he's going to do his rubber hits the road kind of moment, where he's going to start calling us out maybe, if he hasn't already. He says this, "Now salt is good, but if salt should lose its taste, how will it be made salty? If it isn't fit for the soil or for the manure pile, they throw it out. Let anyone who has ears to hear listen." Back in those times, salt was pretty important. We actually get our word salary from salt because the Romans would give a salarium to Roman soldiers so they can purchase salt. And so it was their allowance. So our allowance is a salary, right? And so it was a very important thing. And actually in religious ceremony for the Jews, it was also told in Leviticus 2 that they should put salt on all of their offerings because it was a symbol of purification. Also, if you were someone and you went to the butcher and you needed some meat, what they would do is you'd hack it up and then you'd get some. You'd rub salt on everything that you weren't going to cook immediately because it's not going to hold. You'd dig a hole, throw it in there because hopefully it's cooler down there in the hole than it is up here. And then you'd hide it in there with the salt because what it's doing is it's killing off that surface bacteria so it lasts just a little bit longer. We are supposed to do in this world, Jesus called us the salt of the earth. What we are called to do is have a purifying, persevering effect on the world and those around us. How many of us are living in a neighborhood and if we were to leave, the neighborhood would never know because we have not made an impact at all? How many of us have friends that are so far from Christ and so distant, and they haven't come to Christ at all because we're not having a purifying and preserving effect in their lives? We're just trying to get by because we're only focused on ourselves. This life and this work of the church and of discipleship and of Christianity cannot be done by the few. It needs to be done by us all. Your small group leaders and your pastors and the elders and the trustees of the church, we cannot be the full church for you. I'm not strong enough. Amen. I'm too little. But the whole church together in the world will see our world change because the disciples of Christ are bringing his love and his mercy to everyone around us, having that same preserving and purifying effect that he did in his time here. Embrace him and embrace discipleship so that we are not those that are simply salt that you can't put on the soil because it kills it. You can't put it in the manure pile, which is going to turn into fertilizer because it's going to kill the plants. And so what do? They would take the salt and they'd throw it on the street to be trampled over the feet of men. It wasn't useful. Let us not be a church and a people that are willing to have a life of Christianity and of discipleship that has lost its saltiness. We want to see a world changed. We need to start changing. Now, I wanted to bring this sermon into a happier note, so I brought in Bonhoeffer. And this is what he said, because you know Bonhoeffer. He's so happy. So he said this, "The disciple simply burns his boats and goes ahead. He is called out and has followed the call, and there is no possibility of return. The old life is lost, and the new life has begun." You see what he's saying here? Jesus called you out of the boat that you were in before and you lit it and you left and now there's nothing to go back to. But here's the really funny bit. This made me think of Peter in John 21. He's back at the boat. Jesus died, was resurrected. And then we get this little bit in John chapter 21, where it's often called that Peter is restored. And what happens is the apostle Peter is back in the boat. Remember, he left the boat at the moment of the call? Now, after Christ's work has been accomplished, where do we find him? Back at the boat. You want to know where grace is in that? When Peter went back to the boat, Jesus was on the shore. And he called out to him again. And then Peter put his shirt back on, it tells us, and then swam to Jesus. Let everyone else take care of the fish. And he swam back there. And Jesus asked Peter, "Do you know who I am?" And he said, "Yes, Lord." And so what he does is he restores him in his ministry. So for many of us, we might have been however long in our Christian walk, we said a prayer and we're baptized. But for the last 20, 30, 40 years, we haven't really been living a life of discipleship. And we went back to our boat. Maybe today or sometime else in our lives, we'll finally come to that moment of realization where Jesus is calling us to us on the shore, get out of the boat. And then actually this time we step into the next chapter of our lives when we don't go back to the boat again. Because if we read Peter and Acts, what do we see? He's not back at the boat. Maybe today, maybe you've already done it, amen. Maybe at some point in our lives, we'll get to that picture and that full understanding of what our Jesus' call is so that we burn the boats and realize there's nothing else worth coming back to. It's a difficult, difficult passage that calls us to a standard of life and discipleship in Jesus that is so difficult to attain that thankfully he's going to be back on the shore to remind us to come to him and experience this life of discipleship. The battle, the war is already won. All we have to do is grab the back of Jesus and follow him everywhere he went so that we can continue and learn how to do the job as he did the job, even if it does, and it probably will, cost us everything.